When my wife takes the kids to school in the morning, they listen to a couple morning shows that are broadcast here. I don't know what stations they are, but I am a little curious, and I'm a little worried, to tell you the truth, because sometimes if you just happen to flip around and listen to what's going on in the mornings on radio, it's not the kind of stuff you want the kids listening to. That's become the accepted fare in local radio. Kind of nasty talk, a couple guys and a girl sitting around in a studio, just basically talking about the night they had before at the club or making crude jokes. It's that simple. It's locker room stuff. It's 12-year-old stuff. We should expect it to appeal to 12-year-olds. Why does it appeal to an adult audience, for heaven's sakes? Well, it's a bigger issue, isn't it? Indecency in broadcasting? We're going to start out today's issues, etc., with a conversation I had earlier this afternoon with Congressman John Shimkus on that very subject and several other topics as well. His reaction to the bombings in Spain and in Baghdad this morning as well, and to the Illinois primaries held yesterday. A little story emerging from there. A little later in this hour, Mark Tooley joins us to talk about two issues. One, Planned Parenthood has a chaplain. Did you know they had a chaplain? The National Organization of Planned Parenthood actually has a chaplain. He is a United Methodist. He thinks that Jesus is pro-choice. We'll talk with Mark Tooley about that, and you may have heard this in the news this morning. There's a trial for a lesbian pastor in the United Methodist Church up in Washington. The trial's going to be held in Bothell, actually. She's not only openly gay, she's been openly gay and out for about 3 years. Well, last week she got married in Washington to her lesbian partner. She's on trial now. We'll find out what Tooley has to say about that. In the second hour, two overlapping perspectives on Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. We'll start out talking with Greg Kokel from Stand to Reason, his take on The Passion, what the film could not show you. And then Dr. Fred Bowie joins us here in Studio A. His thoughts, he's seen the film recently, and he's going to bring his artistic perspective and his insight into postmodernism to bear upon The Passion of the Christ. He, of course, is author of the book, The Spiritual Society, What Lurks Beyond Postmodernism. That's the second hour of the program. Then in the third, we'll have a little bit of open lines for your questions. No open lines for questions and comments?
Bowie, 4:35.
Oh, Bowie goes a whole hour. See, I don't usually have my producer standing in here pacing throughout the studio, but he's just corrected me. Fritz will be with us for an hour there to talk about The Passion of the Christ. And then from the last half hour, Pastor Richard Stuckwish will join us to talk about St. Patrick. Of course, if you were driving in today, you might have seen all the green and the parade and some people in the beginning stages of inebriation and stuff like that. Well, what is St. Patrick's Day beyond simply the hoopla and the decadence and the celebration? Pastor Richard Stuckwish joins us in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. to talk about that. Earlier today, I talked with Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois. I began our interview by asking Congressman Shimkus to tell us about the complaints he'd been receiving locally about indecency on the airwaves.
Well, even before the Super Bowl debacle, based upon an FCC ruling, that's the Federal Communications Commission's ruling on a TV show in which the entertainer Bono used swear words in his receipt of the award. The FCC ruled that it was an adjective, not a noun, and it really caused folks in Southern Illinois to be concerned, and our phones rang off the hook saying, you know, this is getting too far. Super Bowl was like throwing gasoline on the fire, and hence we had legislation moving prior to the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl event caused it to be rocket-propelled fuel, and of course you've been following closely. We passed a bill on the floor of the House that increases the fine per incident to $500,000. There's a three strikes you're out provision. There's license review issues. And we've got the major media broadcasters' attention.
Now, tell us a little bit more specifically about H.R. 3717. You just mentioned that.
Well, it's a bill passed the House when we're waiting for this, the Senate, they've passed a bill somewhat similar, but it has not reached the floor of the Senate. And the bill, the basic initial premise was to increase the fines tenfold, and I guess we've we even upped that after our hearings to $500,000 per incident. There is a three strikes you're out provision that if you find no corrective action, you can actually yank the license from the broadcaster. And so some real provisions that have the broadcaster's attention.
How do you respond to someone who says, look, these are the public's airwaves, and yes, of course, there's got to be some kind of regulation, but after all, we're living in the 21st century, and the government has no right to censor what individual private broadcasters with private advertising money are saying on the airwaves?
Well, part of your question is really part of our answer. It is the public airwaves. And what we've done in this legislation is we've not really changed the standards. I mean, the standards of what the entities that want to use public airwaves have to abide by, you know, serving the public interest and prohibition of profane and other activities on the air. That's already the law of the land. All we're doing is upping the fines for a major media conglomerate like Viacom to have a $25,000 fine. You know, they probably pay that on a business executive luncheon sometimes. It just doesn't. A multi-billion-dollar corporation, it just doesn't do anything. By raising the fines per incident, so if you get a shock jock that rattles off in less than 1 minute 10, 15 expletives, all finable at $500,000, you do regain control of the public airwaves. So really the debate, the argument is it's the public airwaves, and we've already defined that if they want to use the public airwaves, they have to do it in this venue, and now the debate's going to be moving. As I made comments in a hearing last week of, what about direct satellite? What about cable? All those really use licensed FCC products, the satellites and stuff, to broadcast and receive. So we'll be looking at how we can control, the cable industry and direct satellite. And they need to start policing themselves up.
At present, does the FCC have any oversight on cable and direct satellite?
Well, the answer is confused. They will initially say no. Cable is in the unregulated market. Cable is a subscription type service. The argument will be that there's no free over the air aspect of cable. But in reality, as I asked a question to all the, to the networks and the cable industry and satellite people, is they all have some type of FCC license. And really, if they're receiving national news stories, a lot of that is being done over the satellite. Those satellites are licensed. So, I think we're going to start making the argument that that what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and that they should fall under scrutiny just like anyone else. And either we'll effect change through legislation, or they'll give the public, really is what we would like to see, a clear and easy way to allow the public to do a la carte menu, a la carte ordering of what they have on cable and on direct satellite.
Someone's going to say, Congressman Shimkus, you're a conservative. Aren't conservatives supposed to be, as a basic tenet of their beliefs, for less government, less regulation?
Well, I am a conservative. I do believe in less government, lower taxes, individual responsibility. What we're trying to do is the corporate entities of today are not, they have no one holding their feet to the fire to be responsible corporate entities. And there has to be some debate and fight on the cultural war that we're fighting. Part of being a conservative, I think, is of the social conservatives, believing that there is a black and a white, a right and a wrong, and then standing on truth, regardless of the culture today that says, you know, can't we just get along and there's shades of gray and everybody's okay, just, you know, give them a chance to explain themselves. You know, I want to be on the side to say, no, you know, this stuff is smut. It's evil. It has no social value. And so if you're going to use the public airways, you need to abide by the rules or take your stuff and sell it other places.
This morning, a bombing in Iraq in a residential area there in Baghdad. Days before, a train bombing in Spain. Has the war effort in Iraq exacerbated worldwide terrorism, Congressman Shimkus?
Well, I think the war on international terrorism is being fought in Iraq. Unfortunately, it's also being fought in Spain. But this is not a time to appease the terrorists. This is another debate of standing in the gap of what's right or wrong. Organizations, and now this is Islamic fascism, that's a dangerous element for democratic governments and democratic regimes. If they are successful in causing democratic governments to cower in their fear and not fight for representative government, the rule of law, individual rights, liberties, and freedoms, then we're going to lose. I enjoy hearing the stories of the soldiers returning who have been over there for a year in constant danger. And the local media, the local hometown newspapers who are interviewing these kids who have come home, they're all extremely positive stories about the changes in Iraq. Polls say today that 70% of the Iraqi people think they're going to be better next year than they are this year. 70% think they're going to be better 5 years from now. So there is a sea change attitude going on in Iraq, and that's why there's stepped up terrorism, because, of course, the Islamic fundamentalists do not want democracy. They don't want the rule of law. They want Islamic fundamentalism, and they want a place where terrorists can have a safe haven. And there's less safe haven in democratic governments than there are in totalitarian regimes.
Do you think that the terrorists were successful in cowering the forces for democracy in Spain, given the fact that 2 days after the train bombing, democracy, the Democratic Party, was basically ousted from there, and socialist leaders were elected in that country?
Yes. It's a failure. And it's a failure from my friends from Spain. They are sending the absolutely wrong message to the terrorists. You would think that their anger would be kindled so much that they would be committed to bringing democracy and freedom not only to Iraq but the rest of the world. Instead of saying, "You're right, we're wrong. You've killed our people. We're retreating. We're leaving." I'm very depressed over it, and it's the exact wrong decision to make.
One final question on a different subject. The gay marriage issue seems to be proliferating throughout the country. Counties, cities are issuing marriage licenses. Every day brings a new story. What's going to happen in D.C. to bring this situation under control?
Well, I'm not sure, but I think that the initial battle will be fought on the Senate floor with a vote in May or June. And pending that result will determine if then that will even get to the floor of the House. At least that's what I'm hearing as of yesterday. And I haven't heard any debate on that today. Again, it's unfortunate that we have to reaffirm, you know, in essence, the Webster's definition of marriage, and keep marriage as between a man and a woman. It's really a ludicrous proposal that we would have to do that. But a lot of us are ready to do that.
Before we let you go, your reaction to the primary elections in your home state, Illinois?
Well, I think a lot of us are glad it's over with, and you're going to see two fresh new faces out about. And I know Jack Ryan real well. I I've campaigned with him, and I think he's articulate and very energetic. I hear great things about it as an individual, Barack Obama. I think, as in anything else, I always talk ideology, conservatives versus liberals, conservatives on spending, social, and the like. If you're conservative, the Republican Party is where you should be, especially in the Senate race. And for all the great things about Barack Obama, he's known as a classic liberal. And so, again, ideological, no matter what party you belong to, if you believe in the conservative causes, I think it'll be an easy choice.
Congressman John Shimkus, thank you for your time and being our guest again on Issues, Etc.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
That's Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional Illinois District. We were talking about indecency in broadcasting, and then, of course, we had to spend some time talking about the latest terrorist attacks in Spain and Baghdad. But one of the things we ended there with had to do with gay marriage. The latest, this is an interesting story. I'm going to hold this until we get to the bottom of the hour and talk a bit about this with some audio that we have on these two Unitarian Universalist ministers that have been charged in New York under New York law for performing same-sex marriages. Now, this is a tricky one, because if they can be charged for performing same-sex marriages, I'm a little curious whether or not, if the law were to change, for instance, whether they could be charged for not performing same-sex marriages. We'll save that for the bottom of the hour. It's open lines for the remainder of this hour, for the next 15 minutes of Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. A little bit of open lines remaining after the break, and then we'll be joined by Mark Tooley to round off the hour, talking about the new chaplain for Planned Parenthood. He says Jesus is pro-choice, and the trial of a lesbian pastor in the church court of the United Methodist Church. Some church bodies have courts. When someone goes against church law, they can try you. You can be removed from the ministry. Well, in the United Methodist Church, although their official position is against open homosexuality in the clergy, they have a lot of openly homosexual clergy, and although their official position seems to be against gay marriage, they have a married lesbian minister. Damon is her name. She's starting trial today in Bothell, Washington. She was married last week. When they decided there in Multnomah County to do some marriages, well, what do you know? She's on trial. She could lose her collar. We'll talk about that with Mark Tooley as well in the remainder of this first hour of Issues, Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, a few items to walk through here in the few minutes left to us before we go to the bottom of the hour. First of all, the latest news, this from USA Today, the Associated Press, is reporting on the latest statement. It's called a communique. It's the latest statement from the Vatican on the issue of in vitro fertilization. Some rather harsh language on that issue. Not unexpected. One might even call this a clarification of a previously stated position on in vitro fertilization. This is what the AP has to say. The Vatican issued a broad condemnation Tuesday of fertility treatments such as in vitro fertilization, calling the destruction of embryos. Now, remember, this calls for some careful discernment. It is not so much the fact that people are trying to find alternative ways to conceive, although there's a problem there within the Roman Catholic Church. But the destruction of human embryos that results from such efforts that the Vatican is condemning. They called the destruction of embryos in the process of in vitro fertilization, quote, a massacre of the innocents. The Vatican newspaper, La Observatoire, I won't even try, it's French. Woohoo! I'll just say that. They published a final communique from the Vatican's Pontifical Academy for Life following a conference hosted last month on the dignity of human procreation and reproductive technologies. They were talking about both the anthropological and the ethical aspects of this technology. In the communique, the Academy restated the Vatican position that any treatment that substitutes for sexual intercourse between a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, such as the creation of an embryo in a laboratory that is later implanted, is considered illicit That is, I think, a fancy word for not good. Because the embryo isn't the fruit of the conjugal union. Now, there's the issue that kind of runs up against the idiosyncrasy that is the Vatican's view on procreation. I call it an idiosyncrasy not because it's necessarily odd or a minority view. It's obviously a majority view. We're talking about 1 billion Roman Catholics nationwide who are supposed to hold this view. Many of them don't, but they are supposed to hold this view. In vitro fertilization loses on two counts ethically if you are Roman Catholic. One, it substitutes some other means of bringing about conception than the normal means that God gave us all. Two, and this one that concerns me far more than simply babies being conceived in the laboratory, the destruction of human embryos. The Academy gave its blessing to therapies that can facilitate the natural sex act. If there are therapies that can, through the normal intercourse between a husband and a wife, bring about conception, they have no problem with that. It didn't give examples, but church officials have said that such things as drugs that help a woman ovulate are considered acceptable by the church since they allow for the possibility of natural fertilization. The basic principle here, and I'm open to be corrected on this, but I think the basic principle here is that in the act of procreation, we're talking about a sacred act given to man and woman by God. And in this sacred act of procreation, God has given us a way to do it, and he has not permitted us any alternatives. So to take the sperm and the egg and to do this in a petri dish would be considered illicit, not good, outside the course of God's gift of procreation. Now, in the statement, the Academy expressed concern that doctors are referring couples more often to in vitro fertilization technologies rather than simply diagnosing and correcting their underlying sterility. I was amazed. Some folks that I know having a little trouble conceiving, how quickly the doctor recommended that they go to the advanced technology. In fact, it was even recommended prior to any formal diagnosis of where the problem lay. Is it a problem with the woman? Is it a problem with the man? Well, we don't know, but you know you can always do in vitro fertilization. So that's a concern that we should probably all share. It condemned the use of embryos for research, which is the dirty little secret of the IVF industry. The dirty little secret of the in vitro fertilization industry is that many of the so-called spare embryos end up in the research lab, or discarded, or left in a frozen state indefinitely. It called the destruction or loss of embryos in the in vitro process, and remember, the process itself also is kind of a trial and error thing. It also leads to the loss of embryos. A true massacre of innocence in our time. No war or catastrophe has ever caused so many victims. When we come back, more open lines for your questions and your comments.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you know God's will for your daily life? Is God's will a mystery? Do we need to look for a sign from God to know what to do at any given moment? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article in the latest edition of the Issues Etc. Journal titled Locus and Focus, God's Will for Your Daily Life. The recent issue also contains a review of Armageddon, the latest in the Left Behind series, and Aaron Wolf details his spiritual journey to the Reformation from the legalism of evangelicalism. His article is titled A Beggar on the Wittenberg Trail. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive the next edition of the Issues Etc. Journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or write Issues Etc. Journal, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on Kurdistan and the spiritual needs of the Kurdish people. They live throughout the Middle East. One person who is learning the Kurdish culture describes a delicate balance in helping start new churches in Kurdistan and sharing Christ with the Muslims. push a little too hard on the accelerator and the whole thing can end up in a ditch. Don't do anything and the church becomes stagnant. Pray that Kurdish families and Islamic spiritual leaders will hear about Christ and see that He is relevant to their culture and way of life. One method of helping the Kurds begin to understand Christ's life is using the book of Proverbs. The idea is using wisdom literature as a bridge to discuss grace and Christ's life. Pray that Christians will have wisdom in presenting Christ's love to Kurdish families in northern Iraq, Iran, and throughout the Middle East. Get prayer updates and mission resources you can use by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Our politically correct culture has me nervous about ever thinking, let alone saying, a word about someone's ethnic heritage. True, stereotyping can be so hurtful. For example, some whites used to say that Noah's son Ham and his descendants were cursed by being made black. That is terrible, and there's no hint of such a thing in the Bible. That said, knowing a person's ethnic background can be so helpful. Growing up in the south suburbs of Chicago, I learned that Americans of Polish and Italian and Irish and Lithuanian and black backgrounds were all raised differently. My big fat Greek wedding didn't describe the German-American culture I was raised in. But what a rich and helpful education that was to grow up in such a melting pot. Jesus used ethnicity in a positive way to show that we should love all people. Not everyone liked the Samaritans, but Jesus did, and made a Samaritan the hero in his famous parable of the Good Samaritan. So, happy St. Patrick's Day to you, especially to you, children of Ireland. What an opportunity for great joy that people from all backgrounds can live together and enrich one another in these United States.
God has saved me. How He has made me His own, and how He now works through me to do fruit of the Holy Spirit. There are things that need to happen in you. For instance, repentance, faith, good works. But guess what? You don't do any of them by your own power, by your own choice. They're done spontaneously by the work of the Holy Spirit.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Okay, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to save that whole Unitarian Universalist audio for an hour of open lines maybe tomorrow on the program, talk about these two ministers in New York that have been charged with performing gay marriages. And the big question that remains there is, you know, if the state can step in and say you can't perform the gay marriages in your churches, are they infringing upon the church's realm? And if they can do it to say, no, you can't do it, can they come in and say, if the law were to change, no, you must do it? We'll talk about that during open lines in a future issues, etc. Let's go to the phones at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Kathy's calling from her car. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if the church, I know infertility has been around, of course, biblically we have records of it for thousands of years, and for no fault of the person's own, for reasons that we don't know, they're infertile. But there's also some things that we do know that cause infertility based on, you know, sometimes today person's behaviors will, because they contract a certain disease, a venereal or that type of some type of disease like that, that they become infertile. Does the church make any distinctions between the cause of infertility and what they would recommend for a couple or not? And I don't know if our church would or other churches do, but I'm just kind of curious about it.
That's a great question, Kathy. In fact, that's one that really needs to be asked. It's kind of the pastoral question, isn't it? I mean, unless one is completely ignorant of the whole issue of infertility, which you can't blame. Pastors can't stay up with all of it. But infertility sometimes has a cause. Sometimes it has a very human cause. Abortion can lead to infertility in women. Did you know that? Of course it can. It has a high incidence of infertility, especially multiple abortions. They can make a woman unable to conceive. So there's another issue. promiscuity in youth, and all the things that come from it, say sexually transmitted diseases, many of them can render both men and women sterile. So you're dealing with moral and ethical issues beyond just in vitro fertilization here, at least from a personal and pastoral perspective, aren't you? You have to. This is what Kathy's saying. This is what I would agree with. You can't simply say, well, we're unable to conceive. Maybe a question needs to be asked by the doctor. Wouldn't the doctor be wise in asking why? I'll tell you what, when you go into the IVF clinic, I can guarantee you that if he's worth his salt and worth the tens of thousands of dollars that you will eventually pay him, he will take your history. He will take a medical history, and he'll want to know things like sexually transmitted diseases, abortion, and other things. Now, Kathy's question is, does the church inquire into this? It certainly should, shouldn't it? It should. We're dealing with issues of sin and repentance. Unless we will just turn a blind eye to this whole issue. Matt is calling from his car. Matt, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hey, Pastor Todd. I was going to say that you kind of mentioned it right at the end there, but the biggest issue is the fact that you can't just make one embryo and put it in a woman, and then that very rarely ever happens. It usually takes multiple embryos, and most of them die. And people know this going into it, and people that have considered this or are considering it should think about that. That the fact is that in a high percentage of cases, most of the embryos they try to implant are going to die before they are able to grow. And the other thing I've just thought philosophically is, talking with people about this at different times, is we don't have a right to have a child. They're gifts from God. And adoption is always a great option.
That is a marvelous point, Mark, and I'm glad you made that. In fact, that's made by the Vatican in their latest missive as well. Thank you for the call, Mark. In fact, the statement that came out from the Vatican via the Vatican's Pontifical Academy for Life says this in part. And this is what Mark had to say. They just say it in a more complicated way. It needs to be repeated that an understandable desire for a child can never transform itself into a pretentious right to a child. And beyond that, at all costs. And the costs are the ones that are significant here. Think about this. Mark's absolutely right. At this point in the technology, it is impossible to simply fertilize one embryo outside the womb, take that one embryo, implant it into a woman, and have success. It may happen 1 in 1,000 times, but if the doctor wants success, and of course that's what he's getting paid for, isn't he? He's not going to implant one, but he's going to implant three. And he's not going to fertilize three, he's going to fertilize a dozen. He's going to give the woman drugs that will stimulate the ovulatory system. She'll have multiple ovulations. He'll take those eggs. He'll harvest them. He'll join them together with the sperm. He will conceive, so to speak, a dozen embryos. He'll put some on ice, literally, into a vat of liquid nitrogen. For later, in case. He'll take three and he'll implant those. All three may die. And there's a real death that occurs here. It is a trial and error process. Now, anyone going into that process has to ask the question, okay, we want a child out of this. But in order to have a child out of this brought to full term, there may be as many as a dozen, maybe even more if you have the money and the willpower to keep going with it, children that will not survive the process. Because the technology is not to the point, right at this point, where we can do a one-for-one and we have a 100% success rate. We're talking about maybe a 10% success rate. That's a serious issue. And what Mark said needs to be reiterated. I'll do it again here in the words of the Vatican. It needs to be repeated that an understandable desire for a child can never transform itself into a pretentious right to a child, and beyond that, at all costs. The big question I have to round off this bit of open lines is this, just something to think about. We'd better think about it. The Vatican has now clarified its position. We now know where the Roman Church stands on this, in vitro fertilization. Other church bodies need to step up and say, do they agree or do they disagree? If they disagree, why? This is not an issue we can afford to remain silent on, especially in an age of human cloning, stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, and in vitro fertilization. We can't say, well, these are murky issues. No. We know what the technology is. We know how it works. And if we fail to speak, we have shirked our responsibility, period. So maybe the Vatican is leading the way. Hopefully, other church bodies will have the courage to follow. For the remainder of this hour, Mark Tooley joins us. He's director of the United Methodist Action Committee for the Institute on Religion and Democracy based in Washington, D.C. We're going to talk about two issues. First of all, Planned Parenthood Federation of America has a chaplain. I was surprised to hear that, period, but they have a chaplain from the United Methodist Church. We'll also be talking about the trial of a lesbian pastor that begins today in Bothell, Washington. She is not only an openly gay lesbian pastor, she just got married. And we'll find out how that trial will go. Mark Tooley, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, always good to be with you.
All right. First of all, tell us about Planned Parenthood Federation of America and their chaplain.
Yeah, Planned Parenthood for about 10 years now has had a clergy advisory board, which it uses to give the impression that churches and the religious community in America is divided over the issue of the sanctity of unborn human life. And most of the clergy who have served on that clergy advisory board have come, by and large, from mainline Protestant denominations. Ignacio Castuera, a Methodist clergyman from California, being one of them. And so it's not entirely surprising that he would be elevated to the position as chaplain for Planned Parenthood.
Now, what is his stated position on abortion? I mean, it would seem obvious if he's going to be the chaplain for Planned Parenthood. He's obviously pro-choice. But how does he justify this or seek to justify this based upon tenets of the Christian faith or Holy Scripture, if so?
Well, he, of course, which would not surprise you, comes from a very theologically liberal position. So, for example, he's also very pro-homosexuality. So his view of scriptural authority is very diminished in that he thinks the scriptures are a flawed document and that one must also take into account traditions and reason and what the church currently thinks within society. And he would say that the unborn human life is not necessarily fully human and would really grant each mother the right to make her own choice as to whether or not to continue with her pregnancy.
He is quoted in an Agape Press story from a May 2003 article in Clergy Voices, a newsletter, as saying that one can extrapolate from all other life-affirming stories about Jesus in the Bible that he would, quote, indeed support a woman's right to choose. How do you react to that?
Well, it's absurd, of course, but I think those on the theologically liberal side, at least the extreme side, have a very high view of individual autonomy and the right of each person to make his or her own moral choices, completely divorced from any other outer authority, much less the scriptures or the traditional Christian understanding of who God is. And so that's very much in keeping with that point of view. Who are we to impose our views of human life sanctity upon any person who decides to take the life of their unborn child?
And you mentioned earlier the impression that Planned Parenthood Federation of America is attempting to give through this new chaplain. How would you correct the impression that not only their position is that of the majority of Americans, but it seems they would like to say that this is also the opinion of mainstream Christianity?
Well, Planned Parenthood, as other abortion advocacy groups understand, believes that its primary opposition is religion in America, especially Christians in America, who have a high view of the sanctity of unborn human life. And so it's been a major objective of not having a consensus on this issue, but is being highly divided. And in fact, they would say that mainstream Christianity favors abortion rights, and it's just what they would call fundamentalists who oppose it. And so they seek out clergy, especially from the mainline Protestant churches, to make their case for them. However, the clergy who come from these mainline Protestant churches who serve the cause of Planned Parenthood, of course, represent the liberal segment of their own denominations. And even if their denominations were supportive entirely of their point of view, those denominations are of themselves a minority within American Christianity. In fact, the vast majority of American Christians belong to churches that have fairly solid and robust teachings about the sanctity of unborn human life, whether they're Roman Catholic, whether they're Southern Baptist, whether they belong to independent evangelical churches or Pentecostal churches. The majority of American Christians, and even more so the majority of Christians around the world, belong to churches that are opposed to abortion.
Does the United Methodist Church, that church to which Ignacio Castuera belongs, does it hold an official position on abortion?
The official stance of the denomination to which I also belong is unfortunately very ambiguous. It says, and in some cases it affirms the right to legal abortion, but it also says it opposes abortion as a means of gender selection or birth control and opposes partial birth abortion. The bureaucracy of our church, especially the lobby office in Washington, its own interpretation is that the Methodist Church opposes any restrictions upon abortion in any situation. However, I think it's safe to say that the majority of Methodists are largely pro-life, not necessarily across the board, but they are certainly would be very uncomfortable with the pro-abortion rights, very strident arguments made by somebody like Ignacio Castuera.
How do you think this casts the United Methodist Church in the public's eye, especially given the fact that there seems to be a dichotomy here? We've got a president, President George W. Bush, who is very openly a devout Christian, a member of the United Methodist Church. At the same time, his church body is willing to lend one of its ministers to Planned Parenthood.
Well, it's a dichotomy that exists within United Methodism and within all the mainline Protestant denominations, in that they all have leadership and centralized church bureaucracies that are very liberal on theology, on social issues like abortion, and politically. So, for example, they're not only pro-abortion rights, many of them are pro-gay marriage. Almost all of them were very opposed to U.S. military action, whether it was Iraq or Afghanistan or any other situation. And would be hostile overall to almost all of the positions that President Bush would take, for example. But the actual membership of mainline Protestant churches tends to be slightly right of center. So the average mainline Protestant, most polls I've seen show that by and large, 55 to 60% of mainline Protestants, for example, vote Republican. And polls of Methodist church members show that about two-thirds of them call themselves conservative.
The other subject we wanted to discuss with you, Mark, is a more recent story having to do with one Reverend Karen Dahman. The story is out of Seattle, and I read the story in the Seattle Times. An openly gay pastor reveals a split in the Methodist Church. Apparently a church trial is underway. Give us the history of the Bothell case, if you would.
Yes, of course, the Methodist Church, like almost all other Christian churches, believes homosexual behavior is a sin and forbids will not ordain practicing homosexuals into the ministry and prohibits the celebration of same-sex unions in Methodist churches. This Karen Dahman in Washington State, a Methodist pastor, came out of the closet 3 years ago and told her bishop, the Methodist bishop of Seattle, that she was a lesbian in what she called a partnered relationship with a woman she was living with. And so basically she was openly thumbing her nose at church law. But I think she had confidence in the fact that she was in a very liberal region of the church, the West Coast, where enforcement of church law on this issue was very lax. So it has taken 3 years to get to the point of a trial. And in fact, several times the bishop tried to institute an investigation that would lead to a trial, and the clergy involved in that process refused to enforce church law because of their own beliefs. So it took the intervention of a national church court to tell that region of the church last fall that you would have to proceed with enforcement of church law, and any clergy involved in that process who, as a matter of day. There will be 13 jurors. All 13 will be clergy. And so potentially the actual trial will begin tomorrow. But to compound the issue, this pastor, Karen Damon, had a wedding for herself and her same-sex partner last week. Since the local jurisdiction out there in Washington State, where Portland is located, began issuing wedding licenses to same-sex partnerships. She'll be coming to her trial not only as a publicly announced practicing lesbian, but also someone who is wed her same-sex partner.
So it's a two-pronged issue. One, she was ordained and then later, that is 3 years ago, came out of the closet, declared herself to be not only a lesbian, but also in a ongoing relationship with her lesbian partner, and then just last week got married. I take it that the trial proceedings were underway before she decided to get married in Portland. Is that correct?
Right. The trial was already scheduled, and I think she told a local newspaper that she went ahead and got married because she wanted to have her companion with her as her spouse to support her during the trial process.
Mark, I'd like your reaction to a representative from a gay rights group called SoulForce. Here's Laura Montgomery Rutt. She says that SoulForce will ask people not to participate in this upcoming trial.
We have freedom of religion in this country, and churches are allowed to be as bigoted as they want to be, but we cannot stand idly by and let and see our brothers and sisters be hurt by homophobia and bigotry. And we're trying to stand up and say, look, you're hurting people by your beliefs.
Now, in addition to that, Rutt also says that she compares the opposition of gay rights to racial discrimination.
Mm-hmm. What we'd like to see is for homophobia to be as unacceptable in the church today as racism is. There was a time when churches used the Bible to justify slavery, to justify segregation, and they're just as wrong today about homosexuality as they were then.
Okay, Mark, first of all, your reaction to Rutt's contention that the church can be as bigoted as it wants, but people should just stay away from this trial and not contribute to the bigotry of the United Methodist Church.
Well, I'm not sure what she means by that, staying away from the trial. My understanding is her organization will be having demonstrators there agitating for their point of view. But, of course, our denomination, the United Methodist Church, like all churches, is a voluntary organization. No one is forced to be a member in it, much less to be an employee of it. And I think the church is just expecting that its paid employees should have to abide by the rules of our denomination. And if they can't, they are free to step aside and seek other employment. And so that's what this case is all about.
And how do you react to the comparison she makes between the opposition to homosexuality and gay marriage in particular, and she compares it to racial discrimination?
Well, that's the constant refrain of the pro-homosexuality side. This is just like the civil rights movement for black people of 40 and 50 years ago, and how can we possibly resist that? It's simply a justice issue. And, of course, I think there's no comparison whatsoever in that it was largely Christians and people of faith who opposed segregation using Christian arguments, saying that all people are equal and that skin color is merely an arbitrary means of judgment and inherently unfair to judge anybody by their skin color or by their ethnic background. Whereas sexual behavior, homosexual or any sexual behavior, is, of course, a behavior, and we as people of faith believe that all people have free will and make choices about what behavior they're going to act out on. And so we would say that it's completely erroneous to compare ethnicity and race, which are morally neutral and beyond choice, to a sexual behavior, which is not morally neutral and which is a matter of choice.
Given the laxity, the sympathy for the gay rights issue and the laxity demonstrated by the clergy in that area of the United Methodist Church, how do you expect this trial to finally come out?
Well, it's difficult to say, but if I had to guess, I would say that the jury will reluctantly find Karen Damon guilty. How can they not? She has publicly announced her lesbianism and has even had a wedding with her partner. But I would be very surprised if they defrocked Karen Damon. I would expect that the punishment will be something relatively light. In effect, giving her a leave of absence or something, so that she would be returning to the pulpit at some point, and
doesn't such a decision, even if they say, okay, she's guilty technically, but there will be no punishment, certainly no defrocking, doesn't that undermine the United Methodist Church's position on homosexuality and gay marriage?
Well, of course it does, and this has been an ongoing issue for years, especially on the West Coast, because the western part of our church is the most strident in opposing church laws regarding marriage and sexual morality. But the irony is those on the liberal side, especially on the West Coast, who argue that their stance is one of open doors and inclusion and one that will win people to the church. In fact, it has proven to be just the opposite. That part of the church is our fastest declining part of Methodism. And the only growing parts of our church are those in the Deep South and overseas, especially in Africa, which are the most adamant about defending scriptural teachings about marriage and sex. But those on the liberal side don't seem to appreciate that irony.
With only 30 seconds here, Bishop William Boyd Grove of West Virginia, retired bishop, will be presiding at the trial. Do you know anything of his position or what to expect from him?
Yes, he has presided over a previous similar trial over a clergyman who conducted a same-sex union where the clergyman was found guilty and was defrocked. Bishop Grove is liberal and probably personally is sympathetic to Karen Damon's position, but I think that he'll be careful to be judicious and fair as he presides over this trial.
Mark Tooley, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Mark Tooley is director of the United Methodist Action Committee for the Institute on Religion and Democracy based in Washington, D.C. Their website, in case you're interested, ird-renew.org. That's ird-renew.org. Now, when we come back, two overlapping positions, two overlapping reactions to The Passion of the Christ, Mel Gibson's film. First, Greg Kokel will join us for about 25 minutes. He's president of Stand to Reason. He'll talk about what you couldn't have seen, what couldn't be filmed, what couldn't be captured for the silver screen of Christ's Passion. And then we'll be talking with Dr. Fred Bowie as well for the remaining hour about The Passion of the Christ as well. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.